Our guest is David Gilmour. We'll find out how he feels about reuniting with his partner Roger Waters and Pink Floyd for the Live 8 concerts and all about his new solo album. We get back here to the World Cafe. David Gilmour, guitarist and songwriter from Pink Floyd, is our guest today. His new solo album is called On an Island, and it's his first solo disc since About Face in 1984. Gilmour recently reunited with his estranged partner in Pink Floyd, Roger Waters, to play a one-off concert at Live 8. We'll talk about that experience today, but it's mostly about music and the rich, relaxing textures of the new album, On an Island. I asked Gilmour if the almost pastoral feel of the album reflected his personal place in a sea of contentment.
It's not quite correct to say it's the album is all pastoral. There's all sorts of other themes and metaphors going on within what happens on the album. You know, people seem to have got this idea that it's all about the peace of my existence, which is not quite exactly where it is.
Well, where does the grit come in to make the pearl at this point?
Well, the song itself, On an Island, is a song about a moment in life. I was in a place with some friends of mine having a good time, and two of those great friends of mine have died in the intervening period. And it's really a song about how people live on in your memories and in your dreams, and that's the only place that they are now. And I miss greatly, but there's a sort of joy still there within it, because they live on, as I say, in my dreams and my...
Well, let's listen to a performance of On an Island, the title track of David Gilmour's new album, recorded live.
Remember that night, white steps in the moonlight. They walked here too, through empty playground, this ghost town. Children again, on rusting swings.
Thank you.
On an Island, our guest is David Gilmour. And David, who are you touring with? Give us a core idea of who's playing.
Well, I have Rick Wright, of course, playing keyboards with us and singing. And, you know, he's my friend and my colleague from going back to the 60s. I also have Phil Manzanera playing guitar with me, who's also, we go back a long, long way. And we have Guy Pratt and John Caron, both of whom are playing the bass and the keyboards and singing. Now, they've been touring with Pink Floyd since 1987, so their years are beginning to tot up there now. 19 years they've been working with me, these guys. And a guy from over here in the States, Steve DeStanislau, playing the drums, who's been playing with Crosby and Nash. And, of course, Crosby and Nash are singing on the record of On an Island.
Kind of an interesting question. Given that you've continued recording as Pink Floyd after Roger left and Rick Wright working with you, and where is there a place where a solo album kind of becomes a Floyd album?
I'm not thinking about Pink Floyd or Pink Floyd albums or anything like that. I'm just doing what I do. You know, this is the time for me to be making the sort of record that I want to make and doing the sort of tour that I want to do on a different scale to what the whole Pink Floyd thing has been. And it feels fantastic to be out with these great, great musicians that I have with me. And I'm afraid the last thing on my mind these days is Pink Floyd. It's an awful long time ago.
Indeed. We're talking with David Gilmour about On an Island, the new album. And the tour that is ongoing to great reviews. Was it fun to put together the set list for this and figure out how to, you know, you have to kind of shoehorn your songs in with things you know people want to hear, and that must be really fun.
It was very difficult. I mean, there's a long, long history of Pink Floyd stuff, of my stuff, and the new album. I always wanted to do on the live shows to do the new album as a whole piece. Mm-hmm. I felt that it is that kind of album that I suppose one might consider a bit old fashioned these days, but it is the sort of album that people listen to, or in my mind anyway, people sort of make a special time for, and they sit down and they listen to the whole thing on a nice sound system or on their headphones and listen to the whole album. It's not sort of one that I really see as something you dip in and out of too much. So I wanted to do that as a live thing as well. So we do the whole first half as the new album, and we've changed the order around a little bit to suit the different occasions. But then the second half, we've been playing some old Syd Barrett songs and some rather obscure early Pink Floyd songs and some more popular Pink Floyd songs. We change it around every night as well.
Well, actually, we're changing around a bit on our little concert today. But I guess it wouldn't be inappropriate to do Take a Breath Now, which is one of my favorites from this disc. What's the origin of that one?
Take a Breath is about trying to teach your children independence and showing them tough love and diving in, getting them to dive in to the deep end of life. It's also about that feeling of being underwater and having to hold your breath for a long time in that beautiful sort of underwater feeling and how those two things sort of combine together.
Well, let us take a deep breath and dive in. This is Take a Breath from David Gilmour.
Take a breath, take a deep breath now. Take a breath, a deep breath now. Take a breath, take a deep breath now. Take a breath, a deep breath now. Take a breath, take a deep breath now. Take a breath, a deep breath now.
More live performance and conversation with David Gilmour today, including remembrance of his early days with Pink Floyd founder Syd Barrett, who actually invited David Gilmour into the band before he left. And also David's feelings about the Pink Floyd Live 8 reunion. Started out by asking David how he grew up and what his parents did.
My father was a zoologist and geneticist, and he worked in Cambridge in England. But he a couple of times took sabbatical years and worked over here in the States. And in fact, in the early 60s, he moved to New York City and lived there for the rest of his working life, working at New York University. And they moved back to England when he retired in his 60s. And yeah, he still lives in London. My mother died a couple of years ago.
But he's still alive. That's great. That's wonderful. How did he feel about your life choices when you were a kid starting out?
He was a bit uneasy, I should say, when I was a teenager and I was getting into this music thing. I think he rather wanted me to go on to doing something slightly more academic than that. But when it became a fait accompli and that was what I was doing, he gave in fairly gracefully.
And it seems to have turned out well, so...
It's done okay, hasn't it?
He can't complain about that. And now, how did music come into your life? Was there any of that involved in the house, or was that an outside thing?
My parents were both fairly musical. You know, there was a lot of music going on in my house. My mother played a bit of piano. My father liked to sing in the bath. My brother and sisters all learnt musical instruments to some extent. I was the one who sort of did the least actual formal musical training. I never learnt the piano or an instrument that required sort of learning to read music. I just picked up a guitar at about 13 and started to learn how to strum on that with the help of a Pete Seeger guitar tutor record that I got.
Pete Seeger is in the news today, and rightfully so, with so many people being affected by what he's done. That's really interesting to hear David Gilmour being affected by that in some way.
I had quite a big sort of folky element in my musical background.
Now, you mentioned Syd Barrett. Was the connection between you and Syd originally musical, or were you friends?
We were friends before we did any music together. We were friends from about the age of 14, I think. And then we went to the same school for a while in Cambridge. When I was about 16, we were for a year at the same school before he moved on to an art school in London.
Hmm.
And we went on holidays together, and we hitchhiked around Europe together.
One of the songs you mentioned going to be doing today is Comfortably Numb, which I understand it was a solo project on the first album originally, or a form of it.
Yes, I wrote it just as I was sort of finishing up that first solo album in 1978, and I was at the studio in the south of France, Super Bear Studios, where we in fact recorded most of The Wall, and I just wrote that little. That tune on a high strung guitar, an unusually strung guitar, and I thought it was good, but I didn't. I had the whole album sort of more or less finished, and I didn't have the energy or the time to move on with that one. So I thought I stuck it away and thought I'll do something with that a bit later.
And so here it comes back as a solo version of Comfortably Numb. This is David Gilmour and the band live today on the World Cafe.
Can you show me where it hurts? There is no
This is my
a version of Comfortably Numb from David Gilmour and this great band. The new album is On an Island. David, I want to talk a little bit about your guitar sound. And one of the things I'm really curious about is, as time has progressed, has technology made it easier for you to get the sound you want?
The sound that I get, I think I've no idea if it's got easier. I think it just is the way that it sounds coming off my fingers. Mm. I could pick up pretty much in any music store in any town. I could pick up an amp and a couple of little effects pedals and a guitar, and that would come out sounding pretty much the same. Mm. Obviously, we work on it and we get better capacitors and valves and get all this technology, but it doesn't seem to sound any different.
Now, guitar fans may know this, but I'm not sure everybody does, but you own a Fender Stratocaster that has a serial number 0001. But my understanding is that is not the first Stratocaster?
It's hard to know exactly. I've taken it to pieces and had a look at all the things. It's made in 1954. The neck and the body were made in 1954, which is the first year the Stratocaster was made. So it is one of the first ones, and I believe it was put together by Leo Fender and given to one of his employees who was leaving, I guess, after a few years. So it's pretty close to being the first Fender, as I understand it.
Wow. How did it come into your life?
It was years and years ago. Actually, one of my roadies found it, and he bought it for himself. And later he wanted to borrow some money to buy a house, and I said, only if you sell me that guitar.
Now, the question is it a good guitar?
It's a fantastic guitar. It's a brilliant guitar. I mean, the Fender Stratocaster, and that one in particular, is to me, is the perfect guitar. It's never really been improved on. I mean, one of the first 1954 Stratocasters, you can play it, and it'll be just like, just perfect. I mean, it is the perfect electric guitar.
Hmm. You know, you kind of, probably because you're used to being asked it, answered a question I wasn't actually totally asking earlier about a Pink Floyd reunion, but I'm more interested in how you're reacting to the questions to that, because you made a statement that was pretty direct early on, and then you made another one that people have kind of interpreted as leaving the door open. Are you learning to use better how to use politician speak as you keep getting asked this?
Well, I struggle with it, you know. I'm not the most articulate human being that's ever walked this earth. You know, now is now.
Right.
That now is what I'm doing. You know, closing a door for no reason is kind of pointless, you know. I don't anticipate any future stuff with Pink Floyd, but, you know, who knows? It's just a pop group. It's just it has this name, Pink Floyd, that people think means something, but it's just a group of guys who got together years ago when we were kids. I was 21, and we worked together very well and enjoyably. But God, do you want to work with all the people that you worked with when you were 21 today? All the time?
I think everybody out there is answering that question for themselves. you know, there was a time when Pink Floyd never left the charts, and when you reunited for Live 8 last summer, something kind of similar happened when sales went up over 1,000% on the albums. And your reaction was I thought, really, really great. You sort of gave them many windfall dollars away. Were you successful in spreading that idea among the other people who were involved with Live 8?
To be honest, I've no idea. I mean, I did suggest it to the other guys in Pink Floyd that they should do this, but they all want to make their own decisions on these things, and they haven't shared their views with me on this stuff. You know, this percentage thing of how much the percentage went up, percentage things are very, very... they don't give you a very accurate view of what's going on when people use these percentage numbers, because if Pink Floyd prior to Live 8 was selling 20 copies a day, and it went up by 1,000%, and it started selling 100 a day, it still is not anywhere in the league of some of the other people that were are more currently in the charts. But it would have been better if they'd put numbers rather than percentages.
Indeed, indeed. Well, David, thank you so much for talking with us today and for playing live. It's a real treat.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks again to David Gilmour. That new album, On an Island, is available at our World Cafe CD store on your web browser at worldcafe.npr.org. Incidentally, there were some live performances we weren't able to fit in our interview today, and they are on the web as web extras at worldcafe.npr.org. Support for the show is provided by the members of the World Cafe affiliates nationwide. They include WUMB in Boston and KRVS in Lafayette, Louisiana. Shows produced at WXPN from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm David Dye. This is the World Cafe.